The Lord be with you.
With your
A reading from the Holy Gospel according to John. On the evening of that first day of the week, when the doors were locked where the disciples were for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and he stood in their midst and he said to them, "Peace be with you." And when he had finished this, he showed them his hands and his side. The disciples rejoiced when they saw the Lord. Jesus said to them again, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, so I send you." And when he had said this, he breathed on them and said to them, "Receive the Holy Spirit. Whose sins you forgive are forgiven them, and whose sins you retain are retained." Thomas, called Didymus, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples said to him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hands, and put my finger into the nail marks, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." Now a week later, his disciples were again inside, and Thomas was with them. Jesus came, although the doors were locked, and he stood in their midst, and he said to them, "Peace be with you." And then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands. Bring your hand and place it into my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believe." And Thomas answered and said to him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus went on to say, "Have you come to believe because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and have believed." Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that through this belief you may have life in his name. The Gospel of the Lord. The narrative of this gospel, which comes from the 20th chapter of the book of John, is very familiar to us. We've all spoken about the doubting Thomas. It has become somewhat a very colloquial phrase which has its origins in this event recorded for us today in the proclamation of the gospel. It's found only in the book of John. And some early scholars, early fathers of the church, looked at this and they thought, it's a sign. It says many other signs, John says, which indicates this is a sign. And early church fathers thought it was a sign of Eucharist, that the believing comes in touching Jesus, touching the broken Jesus, the wounds of Jesus, the bread which is broken, the grapes which are crushed, and somehow the believer touching the broken bread and the grapes, that somehow is related to the wounds of Jesus. And this, early scholars begin to think, probably it may be a reference to the Eucharist. Add to that, it's the first day of the week, which means it's Eucharistic day for the Christian community. As you know, first day of the week is Sunday, and the early followers of Jesus were all Jews, so they celebrated their Shabbat on Saturday, and when the sun went down on Saturday night, now begins the Christian Sabbath. That's how we ended up on Sunday, that somehow the Jewish Sabbath was observed first, and then we followed with Sunday. Therefore, it's the first day of the week when they're gathered together, probably to celebrate the Eucharist. And notice the following week when Thomas is with them, it's also 1 week later, which means the first day of the week. For this reason, some of the early fathers of the church related this as a sign of Eucharist. However, it has many, many angles to it. I've looked at this for the last week in many, many ways and considered the themes that grow out of this. In the early second century, there was a heresy called Gnosticism, coming from the Greek word gnosis, which means knowledge or superlative knowledge or dominant knowledge. Part of this heresy was that the material world is evil, it's bad. And therefore, this risen body of Jesus could not have been flesh. It had to be just spirit, like a ghost. Therefore, you'll find here where Jesus says, probably to counteract this heresy of Gnosticism, here you have saying, touch my wounds. You'll find this in the 24th chapter of the Gospel of John, where Jesus appears to the 11. It's the very end of Luke's Gospel. And they're fearful. They think he's a ghost. And he said, why do you think this way? Why are you disturbed? Touch, see my wounds. A ghost does not have flesh and bones, such as I do here. Touch my wounds. Touch my body, he says in Luke 24. And then he asks them for something to eat. And they give him a piece of cooked fish, and he eats it. And all of this, early church fathers thought, this was probably prompted by the Gnosticism, which says the risen body of Jesus wasn't a real body. It was just a ghost, a spirit. That's some background on this gospel reading. Many of us for years and years have looked on Thomas as a weak person because he was the one who doubted. And yet the one who doubted is the only one in the narratives of the risen Jesus who makes a profession of faith. If you look at the art of the Middle Ages, you'll find that, in fact, almost all of the artistic remembrances of this event have Thomas putting his hand in the side of Jesus. So they actually have him touching Jesus. Doesn't say so in the gospel, but the artistic remembrances in a dramatic way emphasize the fact that he touched Jesus, and in that way he could make this profession of faith. And this would somehow affirm the understanding that perhaps it was a sign of Eucharist. Now, somewhere in life, in some crisis in life, we have all doubted. Well, there might be some mystical, holy people who have never doubted, but in some way, most of us have wondered, why did this happen to me? How can this happen when God is love? Somewhere, every one of us has been visited by doubt. We begin to question, wonder. We begin to consider maybe there is another way. Maybe all the things that were passed on to me by way of belief, perhaps they're not all reliable. In some measure, in a time of crisis, we have all doubted, in great ways or in small ways. Curiously enough, we never doubt in times of prosperity. We never doubt, how could God be so good to me? My goodness, maybe what I think about God isn't enough. I mean, we never doubt in prosperity. We doubt in crisis. So what about this doubt in a time of crisis? Pope Francis says this in an interview in the America magazine in 2013. In this quest to seek and find God in all things, there is still an area of uncertainty. There must be. If a person says that he met God with total certainty and is not touched by a margin of uncertainty, then this is not good, says the Pope. For me, this is an important key. If one has the answers to all the questions, that is a proof that God is not with him. It means that he is a false prophet using religion for himself. The great leaders of the people of God, like Moses, have always left room for doubt. There must be room for the Lord, not for our certainties. We must always be humble, says Pope Francis. Reinhold Niebuhr, of course, says, frantic orthodoxy is not a sign of faith, but a sign of doubt. In Elie Wiesel's book, marvelous, marvelous, his seminal book called Night, about his experience of Auschwitz, he remembers on one occasion where the Gestapo hanged three persons before the whole gathering of the Jewish prisoners at Auschwitz. Two men and a young boy were hanged before them to set an example. The two men died very quickly, but the boy, being so light, stayed alive for a long time. For more than half an hour he stayed there, struggling between life and death, says Elie Wiesel, dying in slow agony under our eyes. And we had to look at him full in the face. He was still alive when I passed in front of him. His tongue was still red. His eyes were not yet glazed. Behind me I heard a man asking, "Where is God now?" And I heard a voice within me answer him, "Where is he? Here he is. Here he is hanging on the gallows." It's the broken Christ. It's the suffering Christ. It's the Christ we meet only in a time of crisis. Only in a time of doubt do we meet the wounds of Christ in ourselves. It's the powerful teaching of this gospel. Paul Lakeland, this distinguished theologian, in his book on ecclesiology, on the church, is very strong in emphasizing the fact we're not a club. We don't all dress the same way. We don't all even think the same way. We don't even all follow the same rules, even though some people would like us to do that. We follow different rules. I mean, do we all use the same envelope on Sunday? We don't always follow the same rules. No, we're a community of very diverse persons. We're different in age. We're different in origins. We're even different in many beliefs. We're different in our doubts. We're a community of diverse gathering of people. And therefore, the church was not founded on structure and is not sustained by structure, says Paul Lakeland. It's founded on this deep down experience of God's infinite love revealed in Jesus Christ. On this deep down fundamental belief, the church is founded, and the church is sustained through that belief, that shared belief. And therefore, we come together in very, very different forms. We're all meeting Christ in different ways. Therefore, a caution against those who presume to make judgments about the manner in which other people pray or in which other people search out and seek an experience of the living God. Be cautious about dominant orthodoxy, which excludes people, makes judgments about people, and makes this unfounded presumption that we have the right to make judgments about the manner in which others pray or seek an experience of God. We're a diverse community. We are bonded and rooted in this deep, deep down experience, not just belief, but experience of God's infinite love for each of us revealed in Jesus Christ. Our prayer is not for uniformity. Our prayer is for unity. Uniformity is stifling. Sometimes it's very overbearing. We must all dress the same way, think the same way. This is not good theology. It's not good community. It's not good church. Unity, the sense that we are bonded in love, we are bonded in forgiveness, we are bonded in understanding the uniqueness of each person, how God is revealed in each person in a very unique way. Those who struggle, those... Hey, last Sunday we had the whole parish showed up. We had these masses standing all over the place. I wish some of them a Merry Christmas because I won't see them until Christmas. But still, they're seeking God. God is present in them. They belong to the family. They belong to the community. They belong to Jesus Christ. So, caution about making judgments about others. The 13th century Persian poet, mystic, calls us in this way. Out beyond right doing and wrong doing, he says, there is a field. I'll see you there, where the soul lies down on the grass, and the world is too big to contemplate. It's a mystical place, a place of peace, a place without judgment. A place where I can be myself and feel God's love surrounding me. A place of serenity. Out beyond right doing and wrong doing, there's a field. I'll see you there.